Hey, if you missed it, we announced the dates for the rest of the films in our Music Box series on HBO. It's a Ringer film special. You might have seen the Woodstock 99 doc that we did, a little sneak preview of the series back this summer. The other five are coming, starting on November 18th on HBO and HBO Max. Jagged, it's about Alanis Morissette. After that, DMX, Kenny G, Saturday Night Fever, the guy who made it, Robert Stigwood. And last but not least, Juice WRLD. 5 weeks in a row, I put the posters on my Instagram, if you didn't see that. Really excited for this series. November 18th, mark it down in your calendar. HBO, HBO Max, Music Box, coming back.
So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe, Ferrero Rocher, je 200 Gramm Packung, nur 2,79 €. Außerdem Mionetto Prosecco Spumante Doc, je 0,75 Liter Flasche, nur 5,99 €. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
We're also brought to you by FanDuel Sportsbook and the Ringer Podcast Network. If you missed part one of this two-part extravaganza, I did some takes at the top, did million-dollar picks with Peter Schrager, and talked to Rembert Brown about the Braves winning the World Series. This is part two, the one, the only Tom Hanks. First, Pearl Jam. All right, Tom Hanks is here. He's been in my life for a long time. Way back in the Bosom Buddies days, I had season tickets for everything you've done for the last 40-plus years. I don't even know where to start.
By the way, we give those away, season tickets. It's not like you paid money for them. They're free.
That's true.
They're available here at the radio station at Happy Donuts down by on Lancashire.
When I was writing for ESPN, I got a mailbag question like 10 years ago. From a reader who said, if you ask 1,000 people to list their top three favorite Tom Hanks movies and you took Gump off the table, you're like, you can't vote for Gump, but you give your next three, that all the responses would be different for all the people. And I actually did a test with 30 people I knew, and 26 of them had completely different lists.
I win.
What are your three? You have to pick three. What are your three? No, well, you got to do it.
No, I do it. But what I would not do it according to the way the movies came out. I would do it by way of the personal experience that I had when I was doing it.
Okay, do that. Let's hear it.
Which is very different. All right. You got three. I can have three, you say?
Three. So you can do degree of difficulty. You can do what it meant the most to you as you're filming it. Whatever categories you want.
Number one, I would probably say number one would be League of Their Own, because all I did all summer was play baseball. I shagged flies. I ate turkey dogs. I took infield with Robin Knight and a ton of other people. I played baseball all summer long in Evansville, Indiana, and in Wrigley Field. You know, there was a day of doing that. And I had all my kids with me. I had all my family with me. It was a big-ass summer. In the Midwest, we lived in a house in the middle of cornfields. We went to a Burger King at night and Dairy Queen in the afternoon. We got our food at Hooks and our drugs at Schnucks. And it was a great summer. And my entire family still speaks about it. Then I would say Castaway, because it was just... We had just bold adventures when we were making that movie. I mean, we were out in the middle of the ocean, just, you know, trying to grab shots. And we were off in Fiji on two different occasions. And I had the whole family with me. There was nothing but adventures every single day, every single night. Understand on Castaway. And these are the creature comforts. Every movie has them. But these were extraordinary. Because let me tell you, Bill, I don't know how you would get to that. Oh, that hideous little box of a studio in Camden, Connecticut. Where were those ESPN studios? Where were they?
Bristol. Yeah.
Bristol, Connecticut. I don't know how you got to work every morning to that. But here's how I got to work every day on Castaway. The sun was not yet up in the east, and I would get up wearing nothing but a Speedo and a T-shirt. And I would make myself a cup of coffee. The house would be quiet. Everybody would be in bed. Stars were out. Moon was out. The sky wasn't even yet to turn blue in the east. And I would make a cup of coffee. Then I would stroll down the road, the gravel road, to where the pier was. And then I would swim out to the special fishing boat, a marlin boat that had these two huge, massive outboard motors on the back of it and a massive fly bridge. And I would swim out to the boat, get on with the pilot and the mate and one of the guys from the crew. And we would head out. And for 50 minutes, the sun would be rising behind us on the open sea. And we would be heading towards the island of Monariki, which is where we shot. And by the time we got to the island, the sun was up. The support boats were there with the rest of the crew. Some of them were already on land. And the boat would stop. And I would come down from the fly bridge, because you couldn't sit in the boat itself because the seas were so heavy. So you really had to stand the entire way. Mm. And I would swim ashore. And then we'd get dressed and do the movie and, you know, Wilson and, you know, all that stuff that was going on. And then at the end of the day, we had to stop about an hour before sunset because there was no power on the island. So we shot during daylight hours, and with an hour left, kind of said, all right, that's it. And the crew had to get back on their boats, and I would swim out to my marlin boat. And this time the sun is setting behind me, and the sky to the east is getting darker and darker and darker. And we would just head for the horizon stars for 50 minutes, me standing on the fly bridge, pondering all that we had shot and what we still had to do. Then we get to the island where we were staying, me and the family, and I would swim ashore, pull myself up by the pier, walk down the gravel driveway to our house, to a lovely dinner outside, and I had two of my boys were young, and they had nothing but adventures, and my wife and my in-laws, they were all there. And that's how we made the movie for not the entire film, but for, I'm going to put together, say, 2.5 months of what that shooting was. That was a vacation. And the last film I would say that was magical for me was a movie called Cloud Atlas that I made with the Wachowskis and Tom Tickford. We shot it on a hope and a dream and nothing but a circle of love in Berlin and Mallorca and Dresden. And I want to say, did we go to Dusseldorf? Did we go to Frankfurt? Somewhere. We were bombing all over Germany. And that was the first time I had ever shot extensively in Germany. And I was surrounded by history. And but the work itself was, we were part of this big, massive ensemble of fantastic people who are just trying to do the hardest, best work on this, I mean, deep throw. I mean, I always say, as Kenny Stabler said, throw deep, baby. That whole movie was such a deep throw that making it was magical. And again, I had a lot of my family come over, and we all saw Berlin and former East Germany, made a lot of cool friends on the German crew over there. And that would be my big three.
That's a good one. That was a great list. I see. I wouldn't have expected that three. I want to talk about Castaway, my favorite Tom Hanks movie. We did this Rewatchables movie podcast. I hosted that one by myself because I felt like I had to, because Chuck was on the island for over an hour. So I had no co-host. I just did the whole thing by myself.
All right. That's good.
It seemed like an intensely personal movie for you. And, you know, you had to put on weight. What you gained, like 50 pounds, and then you had to take 6 months off and then lose a bunch of weight and then start filming it again.
We took a whole year off. We worked on that. Bill Broyles and myself worked on that movie for 4 years, just trying to figure out the three acts.
Yeah.
We really only had an act and a half. It came about because I read an article about FedEx. And I did not realize the common sense of business model that FedEx had. And when I read that planes, huge planes, not 747s, but like DC-10s, you know, filled with nothing but packages, left Los Angeles to fly to Australia every single night at 2 o'clock in the morning. Every single night. So that's a crew of probably six, four, you know, because you got to switch pilots on the way over. And so six people, and nothing but packages, flew across the Pacific every single day, every single night. One going and one coming. So actually, there's two planes. And I thought, oof, what happens if one of those goes down? And from that came the movie. Bill Broyles and I were working on a couple. I knew Bill because he had written Apollo 13, and we'd lived close to each other. And I was a big fan because he had started Texas Monthly, and he'd been the Newsweek editor for a while, and he was one of the forces behind China Beach, the TV show. So we were trying to work out something else. And one day he said to me, what else do you have? What else are you thinking about? And I told him this story about FedEx guys. And I just thought, I think it would be amazing to make a movie about a guy who truly is stranded for 4 years.
So that's the act you have. You have 1.5 acts, but you know you have at least that.
But I knew he landed. We worked on how he got there, and then we worked. And Bill said, "Well, you know, the fact is, just finding food, shelter, water, and fire. Well, that would be dramatic structure unto itself. I mean, there'd be real drama in all those things." And I said, "Yeah, exactly." So we worked on it for 4 years, and then we talked to Bob Zemeckis briefly. And he said, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, well, I don't know, man. You gotta, alone on an island, that's gonna be tough. And then how does he get off? And we said, well, we had ideas like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition shows up with models, you know, and an abandoned, you know, at a desert island. We thought that would be it. We thought maybe, we never came to pirates or anything like that. We never had bad guys, but we thought maybe, you know, some sort of like, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. You get on your own magical island. You know, we thought maybe those guys would show up. Bob never bought any of that, and he went away for 2 years. Then he came back. And what did he say? Yeah. Hey, you're still working on that. We called it Chuck of the Jungle for the while. You're still working on that thing, Chuck of the Jungle? And I said, well, yeah, we are. And we still don't. And he said, well, you know what you need there? And then he mapped out the theme of the rest of Act Two and all of Act Three. And once that happened, then it was just, we had to figure out a way in order to make it, because with that 4 year gap in the middle,
yeah,
that there's no way you could do a special effects version of that. And I was dead set against the idea of putting on a fake beard in the South Pacific and swimming in the ocean, because they're impossible to keep on and they're very uncomfortable. And it would take hours every day to put it on and take it off. So there was no way to shoot it. And Bob said,
Let's be honest, though. You have a ton of juice at this point. You're probably one of the few actors who has the ability to convince a studio to make a movie that you're going to shut down production for a year and then go back.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I would say yes.
Think so. That would be the assumption, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You'd think, you get to do it. No. it's still just money.
Yeah.
And it's still just, you know, hey, not all your movies are hits. You know, there's that. And there's like, well, we don't have it in our, you know, we have a slate of films. We don't have room for anything like this. And they said, well, you know, Bob Zemeckis, Bob, hey, Gump, hey, you know, we got a track record. And they go, yeah, I don't know. This is an expensive movie. And Bob floated to them the idea of, he says, well, you know, if we had any, you know, we had any guts, here's how we'd make this movie. I said, what? Well, we'd make the fat part and then take a year off and you lose all the weight. And we'd come back and shoot the second half, the skinny part, with a year in between.
And that's never been done at this
point. No. I mean, no, there's movies that are like, you know, there's a number of films.
Like the Linklater stuff where they come back, but not like this.
No, not 12 years later. Because here's what had to happen. You know, a production office has to stay open. Cash flow has to be maintained. The crew has to be held. The only advantage it had was only one actor, I guess. Although there was Helen Hunt and Nick Searcy and a few others. But Bob struck a deal with 20th Century Fox. He said, we'll make the first half of this movie, and in the year between, I'll make another movie for you guys.
One for them, one for you.
Yeah, there was, he made, with Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer, he made What Lies Beneath year off that I had, where I was off trying to get, trying to lose the weight and grow the beard and all that stuff. So while he was doing that, I was also working on putting together Band of Brothers. This was like 1999 going into 2000. And when I was off doing a research trip, starving and getting skinny with big hair and all that kind of stuff, I fell in a hole in Berchtesgaden and separated my shoulder, dislocated my shoulder, and had to recover from that for 6 weeks. And that made me lose some of my physical regimen, but I was still able to show up very hairy and very skinny. And we went right back to the same island where we had left a year before and started shooting. And we did, you know, we were figuring out. And in the meantime, in the year between, Bob put together the first half of the movie. And we watched it in real time. And then he said, okay, now that's what we have. What are we going to do? And we, the permutations that the screenplay had gone through in that first half, for example, you know, Chuck Nolan talked to himself a lot. He was, you know, explaining, you know, because you want everybody who reads the script to understand what he's thinking. And Bob was always saying, well, that ain't cinema. That's, you know, that's dialogue. And I said, once we got to the island and we literally came to the first shot of Chuck on the island when he was fat. I said, Bob, I don't know why I'm talking here. Why, who am I? He said, I don't think I should talk unless I think somebody is here.
Yeah.
Or there's a, you know, there's one moment where I sort of say to the pilot who died that I buried, I kind of say, well, that's it. And that's it. And so Bob said, yeah, let's do it. You know, so no dialogue unless who's there? Hey, save me. Or Wilson, you know, that stuff was there. It really did impact the second half of everything we did because it kind of like jump-started it. And we ended up dreaming bigger and getting all sorts of stuff that wasn't on the pages when we returned. Then in the second half when I was, I can't remember if I made fire in the first half or the second half.
No, it was the first half. I remember everything. Yeah. It's the first half.
When I made fire in the first half, I had a slight cut, a blister on my knee. And when I was kneeling in the sand, a piece of organic material got under my skin and gave me a staph infection. That put me in the hospital for 3 days and kept me away from work for 3 weeks. So we lost 3 weeks, but Bob loved it because we were able to rewrite some pages and rebuild a bunch of the set and stuff like that. So that was just one huge, big, massive physiological adventure every step of the way. At the same time, we were really trying to crack a different sort of emotive plane of, well, what does all this mean? What does it mean when, you know, everybody thinks you're dead. The logic of why he's gone, that's the only thing I cared about. I said, once we can understand why he's on this island, and that's where Bob came in with how graphic the crash was and the death of the pilot and the desperate need for fire, water, shelter, food, and then last of all things, company, somebody to talk to. Bob came and said, you know, because we eventually just said, oh, I just absentmindedly drew a face on a volleyball and called it Wilson. And Bob said, nah, you can't, you can't just decide that. It's got to like be a surprise. I think he should be an offspring of Chuck's own blood. And I said, let's figure out a way for me to get cut. Yeah. And I get so mad, I pick up the volleyball and throw it. And then inadvertently is this mark that looks like a face that anyway. So the rest, you know what the rest of the movie is. So that's the kind of thing. I can talk till the cows come home about. And then we came up with this amazing moment, you know, the first scene with Helen Hunt and we had a Lumicra. I could go on and on.
There's interesting lessons about that, though. It took so many years to innovate and add to stuff. I think that's one of the reasons it's a special movie. And I remember I saw it in the theater. I really liked it. I didn't totally understand the ending and it didn't work for me. And the reason I didn't understand it was I literally didn't understand it. And then when I saw it again, when it made the cable rounds, it was one of those, oh, I'm an idiot. He turns around and Bettina, like he's turning back. Yeah. Like, cause he's on the road. He's looking around, but you realize the way it's shot, he turns, and then he turns to the place and he's turning back to where his car was had just come from. It's a lot when you're in the theater, you know, especially if you've had some popcorn and some M&Ms and some soda.
Yeah,
maybe you're not following entirely.
A lot of this is the thing that comes around because you can sort. I mean, that one might have been one of the early films where you could actually see it anytime you wanted to because you know, you didn't have to wait for it to play on HBO or something like that. I think you could actually pull it up, or you know, certainly have the DVD. You could rent it from Blockbuster anytime you wanted to. But Bob was that was not the first movie, but that was the one where all three of us, everybody who was working on Bob, myself, and Bill. That was when we said, there's no hurrying this process.
Yeah.
We just have to figure out what we want to say and then take the time in order to say it. As opposed to, hey, guys, come on, sun's go down. You got to shoot something, you know, say something funny here and get us out of the scene. Look, we'll cut here. We'll go boom, boom, boom. Bob doesn't shoot that way. Bob says, well, I don't know. Well, what do you think we should do here? And this is when we're on an island. Mm. I weigh 140 pounds and I have lice crawling around in my
head. Is that
head.
How much you weighed?
No. I got down to...
It had to be like 160, right?
No. I wanted to. I'm 6 feet tall and I wanted to get down to 159. I didn't. Oof. I got down to about 171, I think.
Damn.
Because I lost those 6 weeks. I couldn't do my workout. For 6 weeks. But by that time, CGI came in and they were able to do a little bit of body sculpting. But I was very skinny. I was very skinny and very hungry.
I think one of the reasons that movie's always on, and my theory with this stuff is these movies are always on because the channels, they know, and the streamers, they're going for clicks, right? They're going for eyeballs. And if somebody is repeatedly watching the same movie, and Castaway is one of those, it's had this 21-year shelf life. I think one of the reasons is it's a weirdly relaxing movie. Like, there's a vibe. You're on an island. It's quiet. Mm-hmm. There's no musical score for, like, an hour.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of have it on as you're doing other things. Meanwhile, there's this horrible plane crash in it. You know, and it's kinda, like, oh, Castaway's on. Great.
It's kind of like a cross between This Old House and Bob. Who's the guy that painted the pictures, you know? The sound of the guy who painted the pictures.
Guy
with the big hair.
Right. They just made a documentary about him.
Yeah, let's add a little tree here. But it has that kind of like tactile feeling.
Bob Ross.
Bob Ross, a golf in the background kind of sound. Oh, that's a lovely layup there on 17.
It's kind of crazy now when you look back. Like, it didn't do as well as the Oscars as I think people thought. And some of that was back. You were in that weird, Michael Jordan was in that mode too, when he lost to Karl Malone. He lost the MVP that year because everyone was kind of, his excellence has been established. People get bored after a while. You had just made all of these great movies in a row. And at some point it starts bouncing off people. It doesn't seem real anymore.
Yeah, but the whole thing is a sweepstakes. You know, every year there's this kind of like big ass playoff that goes on. And, you know, a lot of times the first seed is eliminated, you know, and the team that only won 88 games for the year actually starts playing for the World Series. You know, it's right. Like, and there's no reason to get worked up about it, because at the end of the day, you know, you get invited to the pancake breakfast, you get a little free stuff, and you get to hobnob with all the other famous people in the famous people's club. It's not bad. It's always fun. And then I got to tell you, most people, I am constantly congratulated for winning Best Actor for Castaway.
Really? So people can't even keep track of it.
They don't know.
They just know you won too.
They know. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just love the Philadelphian Castaway. I just loved how you won. You know, it's like, okay, well, thank you very much. And you move on from there.
So your career, and I was there from the beginning. Uncle Ned.
How old are you?
I just turned 52.
Oh, okay.
I watched Bosom Buddies. And then when you crossed over as Uncle Ned on Family Ties, it was kind of a big moment. But TV, there was way more people watching TV back. I mean, 30 million people would watch some of those shows.
Well, that's true. I mean, we were dead last in Bosom Buddies in our time slot. And number one was Tom Selleck on CBS in Magnum P.I.
Right.
And the difference between them was like 28 million people watched Magnum P.I. and 14 million people watched Bosom Buddies. Well, if there was a TV show that got 14 million people now,
you'd be number one.
Oh, it'd be huge. Yeah.
Yeah. And I Michael Keaton was on here a few weeks ago, and we were talking about that era of that early mid 80s era where all of you guys are coming up at the same time, and Seinfeld's coming up, and Leno and Letterman is establishing himself.
Keaton's doing working stiffs. He's doing Murphy, to Murphy. He ends up doing stuff with Ron and Brian. He's on
Night Shift.
Night Shift. Yeah. He started. Yeah. He and I were, for a while, we were like we almost ran into each other on every audition. You know, we were the two, there was a number of us that were just like, oh, here's the relatively funny, goofy guys that are, you know, I've got some stuff under their belt, and let's think about them for these next things.
Yeah. Like, and you easily could have been in Night Shift. He probably could have been in Bachelor Party. Like, you could have swapped like 10 of those movies.
Oh, well, yeah. We could have gone back and forth a couple of times. And every time I'd go and see Keaton in a movie, I said, oh, man, hey, I couldn't have done that. It's good. I wanted it, but I wouldn't have been as good as he.
Well, then you had 1984, you have Splash and Bachelor Party the same year. And it's like, it was incredible vindication for all the Tom Hanks fans. Because they were like, Tom Hanks is a movie star now. I'm like, yeah, I told you. I'm telling you guys about this Tom Hanks guy for years.
Oh, man,
it finally happened.
You know, I'll tell you something. The very first review I read of Splash, you know, this is a big deal, man. I've gone from, you know, worrying about, you know, how I'm going to keep the Pontiac 2000 paid for, you know.
Well, your show got canceled, right? You didn't.
Yeah,
somebody's was gone in 83.
Yeah, I was gone. I was waiting for the phone to ring. And then this movie comes along, and Opie Cunningham is directing it. And nobody wants to make it. And it's for old Disney, you know. Disney doesn't really have any money. And we sort of cobbled together this thing. I had never met Ron. I only knew of him. You know, he wasn't at Paramount Studios when we did Bosom Buddies. He had already left Happy Days and was already directing movies. And so, but he and Brian Grazer were sort of, we were peers. They were older than me, but it was like, you know, everybody grew up with Ron, but he was a cool cat. He would just say, yeah, hey man, it's a wacky business. Wowie zowie. And I thought I was rooting for the funny brother. And then I got a call from him, and he said, listen, we want you for the movie, but we want you for the guy. And I said, oh, Landy. Oh, wow. And he says, so you got that part, but I want you to come in because I need you to read with this actress that I really want. And the studio's giving me some flack, Daryl Hannah. So I want you to come in and do a screen test. And I didn't even know what a screen test was, really. I mean, I'd done some video stuff. And it was going to be a big deal. And I said, oh, great, fine, yes. Can I ask one question? He says, yeah. Is there a way I'm going to lose this job because of this screen test? I said, no, we're only going to see the back of your head. So, that came along. And so we made the movie, and it was damn good. Now, understand, this is really still old show business, the type that has gone with the wind now. Home video was crappy VHSs that were just beginning to show up. VHS machines still cost a family $1,500. You know, there weren't a lot of, if you were able to rent a home video, you had to go like to Doug's tape, you know, Shoppy, OPP. So it was an old-fashioned movie that had to make the money at the box office or wasn't going to do anything, and it ended up being good enough. But the first, I came home really late one night from helping friends build sets or something like that, and lo and behold, Los Angeles Magazine was there, came out once a month, and I knew that it had a review of Splash, and it's 11:30 later than I got two of my kids are sleeping, and I think, should I read this? Should I read this harbinger of the future? Should I read this omen that if it's good, it'll fill me with way too much overconfidence, and if it's bad, it will send me into a hopper of despair? Should I bother doing this right now? I said, yeah, I think I will. So
this is like a real fork in the road moment for you.
Oh, yeah. I actually thought I should probably just let this go until the morning or not read it at all and find out about it after the fact. But I said, I don't think I'll be able to sleep wondering what's in it. So I opened it up to the review pages. And from the first paragraph, you could tell this is a good review for this movie. Mm. Surprising, you know, Ron Howard, you know, pulling up his good references like American Graffiti and some of the TV movies he had did. So this is a guy who is really dedicated. Daryl Hannah, righteously luminous in every way, a woman of mystery. She had already done a couple of things. She had been in Blade Runner. So they're pulling out the really, really, really great references for them. John Candy, the genius of Second City TV. At last, he has found something that translates to this, and this must bode well for great comedy character actors like him, harkening back to the days of entertainers like Jackie Gleason, what had. And on top of that, Eugene Levy. If there's an underappreciated genius in comedy from Second City, it is Gene Levy. Eugene Levy comes in, he doesn't do a lot, but what he does in that movie is just absolutely priceless. And I read the rest of the review, and it mentioned the DP, and it mentioned a couple of things, and said it was coming at Disney, from Disney, for Touchdown. It didn't mention my name.
Oh my God.
It said nothing about me. My name did not appear in the review. So it's now, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. And all I could remember is thinking of like, well, there's the yin to the yang of thinking the movie was pretty good. So is there a lesson to be learned here? What have you learned? Well, I think the lesson is that, this too shall pass, man. You got to let the bad stuff roll off. You got to let the good stuff roll off and go away as well.
But then you eventually got good reviews and then you're off.
Yeah, the movie was very popular and
people liked it.
Yeah, they did. And it was a lovely movie. And about a million girls were named Madison, you know, after that, because Madison, mm-hmm. That's who Daryl, the mermaid's name was Madison. And and then after that, people said, hey, you're in a movie, so we want you to be in a bunch of other movies too. And I just kept doing them.
Started cranking them out. Plus.
Well, yeah. Hey, they offered me a job, man.
Yeah.
No, you kidding? You don't say no to a job.
A lot of them have held up. At the same time, now you're popping on Letterman. You have chemistry with him. That's like the best late night show. And you start doing the SNL hosting and you become one of the best, recurring hosts that they've ever had. So you have, you have this weird relationship with two of the most important three late night properties, I would say, the last 40 years. You're just kind of in the middle of it. But especially the SNL stuff. I think those guys would have had you on twice a year if you would have done it. Like, why do you feel like you were the unofficial cast member?
I'm glad I got on by that, just because I was, you know, some guy promoting some movie, because if I had tried to audition for it, I would have choked. I never would have been able to been in the company. It's just I was able to come in at their invitation as opposed to trying to get it. I could not quite fathom that was part of it, because when we were doing Bosom Buddies, you know, Peter Scolari and I would examine David Letterman at night. That's SCTV as well. And of course, SNL was still it had just come off that, you know, those other kind of the years of the Dick Ebersol years. So yeah. I didn't do it until it was kind of Lauren was back. And I had enough P&A money, print and advertising money for it to warrant an invitation. So the first, you remember very well the first time you're on a show like SNL, or the first time you come up out on David Letterman and you do a pretty good spot. Look, I'm not a stand-up comedian. I didn't have an act. I was just trying to get by on, you know, charm and joy de vivre. I was just trying to be as funny as the rest of the show. That's it. And if that meant being louder than anybody else, well, then you'd hear my voice instead.
And then you get big in like 1988. And at that point, you're an A-list comic actor at that point. But big,
well,
you say A-minus?
I'd say the best guy on the B team. I think I was still junior varsity. You know, at that time, you know, the studios were all trying to come out with some less shinier version or less hip version of what Bill Murray was doing. You know, Bill and Danny Aykroyd and, you know, the Ghostbusters. Actually, anything that Bill Murray did.
And Chevy was the other one.
Yeah, they were such a level of commercial. Not only were they incredibly popular, but there was also some magic elixir that was being done by the likes of those guys. So if you were kind of goofy looking, and could, you know, had any sort of degree of charm, there was this whole kind of like lesser market for that stuff. I mean, if you go back, there's a ton of movies that are set in an arena that is about a young guy trying to fall in love, have sex, and give it to the man at the same time, you know. Go against the rules. He's unpredictable. There was an awful lot of guys like that. And I was able to ride that for quite some time just because it was coin of the realm. They were churning that stuff out.
Yeah, Bachelor Party is a funny one because it's like, what is this guy rebelling against?
Yeah, because there's one guy at the Bachelor Party who was fighting to not get late at the Bachelor Party. He's like, no, everybody else do it. I'm not going to.
His wife's rich family. He's like, he just can't quite fit in with the rich family because he doesn't play tennis as much. Yeah, it was good. The '80s were hilarious.
Yeah, they were. In a lot of ways, that was the hipper stuff that was being offered on TV. You know, towards the mid '80s, well, with the resurgence of SNL, and you have to give David Letterman, not just props, but He brought a. I still miss him. I always think somehow. I'm going to stay up late at night. I can watch Letterman, and he's not there. He brought that kind of like commentary wryness to who we are as a nation. It wasn't just irony, because irony becomes the haven for the pontificating. He never pontificated, but he was everything from the top 10 list to the home office, you know, in Omaha to his mom and pie. So Larry Bud Melman, and also the combination of him with Paul.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, here's an hour for us, the folks that have not been able to break into the mainstream yet. They gave us an hour at 12:30 at night. Along with SNL, that by that time was that was the institution, because that was the granddaddy of them all. But it still only came on once a week. The fact that Dave was on every night, you know, right at the time when you could set your recorders, you know, by and have it the next morning. That was a godsend. That was a comedic godsend, because there was also a theme that he was examining, and that was. Can you believe they're getting away with this? It was that kind of thing. And, you know, in all honesty, ESPN came along more or less at the same time.
Yep.
With let's just go right to the highlights and come up with the, you know, funny callbacks to everything. I still say something that Stuart, he passed Stuart away Scott. From.
Yep.
Stuart Scott, he did this thing where he would show like an error of a guy under a pop fly, and he would blow it, and it was definitely worth a highlight reel. But he always did this thing, and it's hit deep in the center, deep in the short left, and and so I still do that every now. I can't why huh, I still do it.
Well, there was a lot less groupthink back then too, where if you like something, unless your friends like. Also agreed that they liked it. You didn't really know who else liked it. So you would gravitate toward these things.
Well,
ESPN's a good example. You'd be like, I love that Sports Center anchor. But you had no idea if like a million other people loved them. You just knew.
Oh, yeah. You didn't. As a matter of fact, when you go into the movies, you didn't really know if they were good or not till Monday. Because the people on Friday went to the movies. And when they came to work on Monday, or they came to school on Monday, they said it was either great and hilarious or not. And movies played for a lot longer in theaters, so you actually did sort of like discover them. That began to change by the time. What year? You can tell me what year was Big? Was that 86, 87?
That Big was 88. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was still pre-phones, but it was by that time it was huge. Home video was already going off, and all the budgets were there. Anytime a movie came out, everybody who was in it went off on a kind of like a I always called it the celebrity mule train. It was a month-long dog and pony show where you went all over America first and then all over Europe later on. And everybody wanted to talk to you and everybody wanted to cover it. And everybody wanted to. It was coin of the realm. I mean, it was like as much of a commodity to the economy as was crude oil or, you know, a new model car that was suddenly selling a lot or not selling a lot.
Well, there was also... It's funny, Keaton and I just talked about this because he had Batman in 89.
Yeah.
And
there
was that whole infrastructure that was moving in place, right? Where we had Blockbuster, where you could rewatch the movies. But then you had that Premiere Magazine kind of culture where for the first time I knew what movies were coming and the casting decisions. I remember Bonfire of the Vanities, which was...
That was huge. That was
a movie.
Yeah.
There was so much anticipation for who the three were going to be. And you were one of the stars.
Me and then Bruce and Melanie. Yeah.
And then kind of people were ready to get mad if it wasn't good. And then with that one, that movie took a lot of shit.
Oh, you know, oh my God, did it. But when we were doing it, Brian De Palma directed it. And I always said, look, Brian, this movie is either going to be Gone with the Wind that everybody loved or The Fountainhead that everybody hated. This is going to be binary, man. Because the book itself, you know, Tom, by the way, it came out just like, I want to say 50 years ago today or 40 years ago today or something. The book itself, it's the story of the interior thoughts of everybody. And visually, it's about like styrofoam peanuts rattling around in the back of a car. And that stuff's hard to capture cinematically. And, the book was so huge and had so many anticipations. I had people, before we even started making it, I had people stopping me on the street saying, you are not Sherman McCoy.
They felt an attachment to him.
Yeah. I said, duly noted. Thank you very much. But that's secondary to just the fact of how hard that is to do in the first place. You know, there is a great clip of Clark Gable at the premiere of Gone with the Wind in Atlanta in 1939, in which they said, well, you know, it's all that old fashioned, well, Mr. Gable, I'm sure that everybody here is greatly looking forward to your role as Rhett Butler. Do you have any expectations of how you're feeling right now? And Clark Gable, well, as everyone knows, those who have read the book have a very specific sense of who Rhett Butler is. My hope only is that, well, I live up to what that sense is. And if I do not, well, that's just tough luck. He says something like that. And that is the case with any movie that you're making from a much beloved novel. So the lesson there is this too shall pass. Just because it's a great novel doesn't mean that you have anything built into what's going to be coming along with a motion picture. It's got to click on all cylinders. Otherwise, it just don't.
Well, you think like that movie's a big swing. Big is a big swing. Big is a movie that probably shouldn't work, like fundamentally. And yet it is one of the most beloved movies of its kind of the last 35 years. It lives on. People pass it to their kids.
Oh,
I remember
yeah.
the first time my kids were old enough to watch that, immediately put that on. And it's just going to go on for the next 200 years. There's also a world in which that movie's a disaster and it goes away and nobody ever thinks of it again in a month, right?
The way things are so cyclical, we were the last of four movies that were essentially dealing with the same gimmick.
The body switch gimmick, yeah.
The body switch gimmick of an old guy into a young guy's body or vice versa. I think that was the name of one of the movies, vice versa. And we were...
Judge Reinhold, you're right.
Oh, was that right? Okay.
Yeah.
And we came out last. You know, we were the last of the four to come out. And it was just inexplicably fabulous. But look, this was all Penny. I mean, Penny, it was Jim Brooks and Penny Marshall. This is my understanding of the backstory was that Whoopi Goldberg was making a movie called Jumpin' Jack Flash. And for two weeks, it wasn't going well. And Jim Brooks called up Penny Marshall and said, you are a director of motion pictures and you are going to come in and direct this movie on Monday. Jumpin' Jack Flash. So they fired one day. And if you do that, I will give you, you will direct your next movie and we'll figure out what that is later on. So it was all her. And she directed and cast. Everything that she did was slow to the point of maddening, methodical. Why is this taking so long? And I'll tell you this one story. Both Penny and Bob Greenhut, who was the producer, the line producer. So we were in New York, and we were shooting the movie. And look, on some ways, I have an instinct of what I wanted to do, but in other times, I'm desperate for anybody to help. You know, right. The costume, Penny. How do you want this? What should we do? I think I'd do this, but is that going to be enough? And Penny shot a lot of takes and tried this and tried that and la, la, la. So we had shot a version of the Zoltar machine at Rye Playland. We shot a version of it where I wish I was big, or no, actually the final thing where I go back to him and try to get turned back into a kid. We shot one version of it and it didn't work. So we ended up putting in the schedule to shoot another version of it, which we did. And then Penny decided they actually needed even more of what it was. And that didn't quite work. So they came back. Bob Green, we're actually shooting the scene in a bank in Manhattan where I cash my check for the first time and get cash with a young Billy Rushton. And Bob Greenhut came up and said, "Hey, did you hear we're going to go back and shoot some more in Rye at the Zoltar machine?" And I said, "Why? I mean, geez, we've had three passes at it. Penny, are we actually going back and shooting some more at the Zoltar thing?" Yeah, we need to try something. I said, "Look, guys, we're wasting time. We got to do the whole Michigas, and I'm going to have to get back in the emotive state, and we're going to have to do it again. Can't we just, you know, table it? Let's finish the movie, cut it together, and then figure out what the scene should be after that." He said, "Well, I mean, Penny has it. I want to try this. Well, we're going to keep trying stuff, and it's never going to work. We're never going to find out. I mean, why in the world are we going back to shoot this a fourth time?" And Bob Greenhut said, "Because they're letting us." I said, "Oh, okay. All right. Actually, I understand that. Okay. All right. We did that." And that's one of those lessons that you learn. It's like, never turn down a chance to do it again. Never, never not take another swing at that thing. Always come back and say, "Oh, we're going to go back and do some more. Great. Let's try this. Or you want another take, Tom? Sure. Let's do it. Well, just shoot until we lose the light. I'll go on as many times as you want." That's what I do now. Wasn't quite aware of the richness and the luxury of that opportunity then. Because, you know, you're full of yourself and you think that nothing's more important than making the day.
I think you undersold your performance in that movie.
Well,
I think
that
was an incredibly, incredibly hard movie to pull off. You're playing somebody who's 13-year-old internally, but it's built like a 30-year-old, and you have to have kind of that kind of clumsiness that somebody has when they're 12, 13. Like, there's some real thought put into that.
It's hard to know. I don't know how to explain what the process is, because I mean, how'd you come up with that moment? I don't know, man. You just throw yourself into a maelstrom of self-doubt, self-loathing, and some degree of instinct that takes you where you're going to go and you try it. The thing is, this was a while back, and I had done Punchline with Sally Field and David Seltzer before we made Big, and then we made Big afterward, but they were released in the opposite way. So I had just gone through this grown-up, bitter, really screwed-up comedian that just needed more of everything for his own ego and salvation and existence. And got beaten up in the whole process of trying to come up with an act and all of, and working with Sally as well, who was a gem, and at the same time was doing this ephemeral thing that I didn't quite recognize as performing in a motion picture. And I was like, I can't even see what she's doing here. And I'm as loud can be. So going from that and then working with Penny, it ended up being kind of like I learned how to be more interior, I guess, in that, and keep a hell of a lot more stuff in my pocket as opposed to screaming at it at the top of my lungs.
It's such an innocent movie for a way more innocent time. I always think like if Big came out in 2021, there would be think pieces about, is it okay that Elizabeth Perkins' character still liked him once she found out she was 13? You'd head down all these rabbit holes. I'm like, no. Can I just enjoy this movie? Can I just enjoy the concept of a 13-year-old organically falling in love as an adult with somebody for a little while?
Well, it's like you take all of these movies and ponder, what is anybody going to start texting in the first 15 minutes of any one of these movies?
You know? Oh, yeah.
What are they going to be sending their friends? What are their comments going to be on? Which is an unfair, I think, comparison to make between now and then, because it wasn't in our imaginations of being able to do so. And now
you're not thinking of worst case scenarios in 1988. You're just trying to make a movie.
You're actually willing to sit there. You have nothing else to do except get your money's worth from a movie like that. And I think, my Lord, I wouldn't be surprised if movies come back and have to take into account the TikTok effect, which would be when you go sit in a movie and it's 2/3 full, how soon do you see out of the corner of your eye some patron pull out their phone and start looking at TikTok videos because they don't
5 minutes in.
Exactly. Yeah. And then how many of them are, and how many do you really see, and how long do they go in the course of what the movie is? Because, you know, that's where our attention span is.
Well, then you peaked as an actor the following year, but doing entire scenes with a St. Bernard. And pulling it off. Some of the best work of your career.
Oh,
Turner and Hooch. Killed the dog. You killed the dog at the end of it.
The hardest work I have ever. I mean, I was glad I was a young man because I couldn't work that hard now. We had, they were actually called Dog de Bordeaux. They were these huge French versions of Mastiffs.
Right.
But the dogs were just sweethearts. But the problem is, unless you have a real tactile connection to that dog, there is going to be nothing on that screen. It's going to just be a dog looking at their trainer off camera, waiting for their 1/4 of a hot dog to be, you know, given to them. That both of those dogs, Barry and Beasley, were their names. I wrestled with them. I exchanged spit with them. I scratched them all over the place. I would grab their skin and their heads. There's a couple of shots in there in the movie in which truly it's me and a dog playing. And the dog, I think, was actually thinking, hey, this guy's okay.
You run him over.
The other, I just worked with a dog in the other movie that's coming out, and it was the same exact thing. You have to get into that place where you can see it in their eyes, their big brown eyes, where they look at you and they say, hey, you're all right. I'll actually look at you.
It's not much different than if you're doing a rom-com and you have to click with like Meg Ryan. At some point, you have to be present in the moment with who your star is, dog
there,
or
there
female.
There is a connection that goes on between really good, solid professional actors. That is, I think, where you just pick up every day right where you left off. And
yeah.
Taking away, you know, they're taking away this, the concept of flirting, you know, that goes on. I mean, in the workplace,
yeah,
or any kind of like unresolved sexual tension and stuff, and just being pals and laughing and getting through all that kind of stuff. That ends up being one of the better joys, because the women actors that I've worked with, actresses is not really the starlets is not the word used. The woman actors, you know, definitely Meg, Julia Roberts, Helen Hunt. When you get to that place where you're sort of always talking about the acting, but you're actually just trying to recreate the kind of behavior and being in the scenes.
Yeah,
that really is the high country. Meryl, I'll drop that bomb. Working with Meryl Streep in The Post. That was a thing where I was like, oh, this is so luxurious, because we're just behaving. We're not performing. We're not posing. We're not trying to put curly cues on all of our lines. We're not being sandbagged back and forth. We're actually engaged like when you're playing a great card game and all you're doing is laughing, and at the same time, you're trying to win. So I made 3 movies with Meg, and every one of them was completely different from the other. And it was kind of tough, because all you do is laugh, you know? You get to the point where every day is just that kind of like this kook fest, and you kind of like turn and say, do we have it? Did we say the words the way you wanted them to be said, or were we just goofing around for that whole thing?
Can you tell when younger actors have it? Like, you worked with Damon at a really young point in his career, Saving Private Ryan. You worked with Leo when he wasn't fully formed Leo yet. I mean, he was on his way.
I'd say he was Leo, yeah. You get it from absolutely everybody. You know, it's you can tell someone the sensibility. Well, I will say this. I didn't know for the longest time. I did not know. I don't know what movie it was that I did where I figured out there was something more important than showing up on time and knowing the lines.
Yeah.
At some point, you have to show up on time and know the lines and have an idea that is unique to yourself that you either talk about or demonstrate. And it has to be inclusive. It has to be additive to the process, meaning that you can't show up and say, you know, I think I'll jump out the window in this scene. You can't jump out the window in this scene because you're not in the rest of the scene and they can't replace the window fast enough. So when you're all those, I don't think I've ever worked with someone that didn't come in and bring something new that was that you're able to play off of sometime in an intimidating fashion in which it's like, oh wait, this is a pitcher's duel. I mean, when I did Philadelphia with Denzel, you can't ask for an actor who is farther atop his game than Denzel was and still is. And what comes along with that is like, hey dude, I'm throwing heat. I'm not telling you I'm throwing heat. I'm throwing heat. All right?
Right.
So you're going to catch it, and then what are you going to come back at me with? Oh, you're throwing heat too. All right. Well, I'm going to go off speed on you now, bad boy. What do you think of that? Oh, you got a piece of that. Okay. Hey, that was a chin. It's like that. And that is the additive process of sometimes it's mano a mano, and sometimes it's laying down the red dot that the scene is all about. And when you're working with someone who doesn't take into account either one of those things, you know, it's a problem. And I couldn't come up with the name of someone who did that didn't last. But when you after at the end of the day, if you just, you know, think, you know, that wasn't that good a game, man. You know, that's I'm not sure I'd pick him for the top five anymore. Or it's right. And there's just no denying it. You can't get away from it.
Did you know your career was going to pivot the way it did in the 90s? Or was it one of those things like a film by film? It's like, oh, you're offering me that? Oh, I get to do that?
And I had done that. I'll tell you, Bill Simmons, I had done that for the first 10 years of being in the movies. If they asked me, I looked at it and said, I can make this work. Oh, this is, let watch me go. And then it wasn't until... I can't.
Well, you had League of Their Own. You had Philadelphia, Sleepless in Seattle, kind of in all the same area.
That's right. Whatever I had done before League of Their Own, I had had a meeting.
Bonfire of the Vanities?
Okay, there was that in there. That was there. And I don't want it to sound like, oh, I made a movie that nobody liked, and so therefore. It was actually a zeitgeisty.
Oh, Joe versus the Volcano?
Okay, I made Joe versus the Volcano, and there was some really great stuff in that. But at the end of the day, I had to look at what my part of all those movies were, what I brought to them, you know, other than showing up on time and knowing my lines. What an additive quality that I bring to them. And I came away understanding that I was now 35. I was in my mid-30s. I had three kids. Had been through enough of getting my ass kicked when I thought everything was going to be groovy, and finding out everything was groovy when, in fact, I thought I had failed miserable. And I said, okay. I sat down with my crack team of show business experts and said, now my kids hate it when I use this word because I don't mean it in the way, in a pejorative fashion. I mean it in a way of what I'm looking for. I mean it in a way of a level of maturity and a level of life experience and a level of expectation. I told my agent, I don't want to play pussies anymore. And by that, I mean guys who whine, guys who say boo-hoo-hoo, I need something more in my life. Who am I going to be? What am I going to do with my life? oh, I'm in a circumstance that I need to extricate myself. So I'll only use that word once because it's got different sort of connotations now that I'd rather be able to define myself. But so I said, it's now time to play adults who go through bitter compromise. Mm. And the first movie that came out of that was League of Their Own, which had actually had been around and then disappeared and then came back around. And when I met with Penny about it, it was our second movie together. Penny said, you got to get fat. So what? So you're too young. You know, this is for an old broken down guy. You can't be good looking. You can't be charming around. These ladies can't fall in love with you. And those are the movies that you make. So you can't. And I said, well, let me put on some weight. And then let me also play this bitter moment of compromise. I blew my knee out in a stupid way. I would have been Jimmy Fox. I would have been Lou Gehrig. I would have been Stan Musial. But I was jumping out of some girl's hotel room. I landed on my knee. And just like Mickey Mantle hitting that water sprinkler out in right field in Yankee Stadium, I didn't take care of myself. And so here I am. And Penny said, all right, that could work. Well, you going to walk with a limp? Yeah, I'll walk with a limp. Okay, maybe a cane. You know, so that got us.
That was it.
Yeah.
So you went, the characters became complicated and that unlocked you.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can't play a young guy. I mean, look, I'm 65 now. Everybody knows. You know how long you've been watching me, you know.
Yeah. The character you haven't done yet, and you've done just about everybody, but I know you love the movie Boogie Nights.
Oh, my Lord, yeah.
You haven't had the Jack Horner kind of supporting role where you just go off the path for a role, but it still feels like you, but part of the thrill is, oh, wow, he's playing this guy?
Well, I don't...
Have you done that yet?
I don't know how big the advance is on talking about movies in the future, but with the great Austin Butler as Elvis Presley, written and directed by Baz Luhrmann, I play Colonel Tom Parker.
What? When is that?
That'll be out hopefully June of 2022.
Oh, so there you go. That could be your Jack Horner movie.
Wow. That was a wild ride. Yeah. And Colonel Tom Parker was Elvis's promoter, not his manager, not his manager. Don't call him a manager. He was Elvis Presley's promoter. And I would put him into the realm of a guy of great charm, but questionable morals, and sometimes not great charm either. Sometimes quite a lot of boorishness.
That's perfect. I like that one. All right. Quick questions before we go. Because I already kept you too long. Sleepless in Seattle. How long do they actually stay together after they get off the Empire State Building? Do you think they're together for life, or is that like 6 months falls apart?
No, I think that's for the long haul because they ain't kids. You know, they've been around.
You think that's it? This weird lady that meets him at the tower. He's like, this is the stepmother for my child. This is the one.
And I'll tell you why, because that guy knows how to be married. He knows, you know, he knows how the bumps on the road. He knows how to, I'm not going to sweat that detail. He knows how to say whatever you want, or said, no, I'm not going, but you have a good time. He knows how to do that now. So no, okay. That's the long haul.
Forrest Gump, the running scene.
Which one?
It's like 8 minutes. He's running back and forth across the country.
Oh, across the country.
Years.
Oh, my
He's
gosh.
Back and forth.
Yes.
It goes on forever.
We flew to all those places. And my brother Jim went the farthest to get dressed up like me.
Your running stunt double, right?
Yeah, in a couple of shots. And we still have arguments. I said, that was me. That was me. No, buddy. That's me. I remember doing that.
So Forrest is just, he's just going back and forth. Like, who's paying the bills? Where's he going to the bathroom? Is he staying in hotels? What's going on there?
That was one of those things where I think I actually raised my voice to Bob because I couldn't fathom the logic of it. And we ended up we ended up adding a line to the voiceover that said, you know, when I was tired, I slept. And when I was hungry, I ate. And when I had to, you know, well, then I went, you know, because I couldn't take this idea of just a guy running across the country doing nothing and just never taking off a piece of clothes. So if you look, Joanna Johnson had done this thing where I never took off anything I put on. And Bob thought it was hilarious. I just think it's funny. I think it's hilarious. You know, he put something. I said, Bob, that's contrary to human behavior. I can see him getting something and wearing it out and then getting something new, but he's not going to show up at the end of this thing. But yeah, we, I tell you, there was one time we were shooting the movie and I worked because we would fly off to one of those locations first thing Saturday morning, shoot Saturday and Sunday, and then fly back and then be back on the set in South Carolina. On Monday morning, there was one period of time where I shot 27 days straight because we were either shooting the movie or we were shooting in Maine or North Carolina or Vermont, New Hampshire. Monument Valley. We ended up, and that was Bob. That was Bob. So now we got to get these shots, man.
That movie's done a nice, it comes out, it makes an incredible amount of money. It does really well with the awards. Then people get mad because it was the Pulp Fiction Shawshank year. And they're like, no, maybe this should. And now it's like circled back around where it's like, you know, it's a really good movie, Forrest Gump. it's landed in the right spot all these years later.
We were diabolical geniuses because it was too successful.
People got mad. They're like, fuck this.
If we had done half the business and then, you know, split it up, you know, between, you know, Pulp Fiction and Shawshank, that's true. Those were kind of like three granddaddy, big swing, mega, mega perfect films.
Yeah.
But they were all so friggin' different one from the next that you had to pick one that was the vanilla. And because it played all year long for crying out.
Oh my God. What a year that was.
And beat the living daylights out of me.
Castaway. So he goes to Helen Hunt's house.
Mm-hmm. Mary's
the dentist. A little fast, in my opinion. I don't know if there was enough grieving on the Helen Hunt side. I just immediately, I asked her out, they get married, they have a kid.
Dude, no, we talked about it. We talked about this whole thing. Helen's no pushover, you know? So we're thinking like, okay, he goes away. The word comes in the next day that the plane has gone down. And so there's a 2 week search and rescue. They don't find him because they have no idea where it is. And
she's already going on dates at that point. They're probably not finding him. The dentist asked me out.
No, give her a year. give her a full year.
She had a kid, 2 year old kid. She was just moving on.
I'll tell you. There's a moment in that we were trying to figure out a line. We did not have it. We had to figure out a line that I said or she said, and we both realized that is the measure of how much time had passed and how angry Chuck was that she married somebody else.
Yeah, he should have been.
And the line was this: after I've seen pictures of her family on the refrigerator and we see all this stuff, and we wrote on the set and Bob was there. And I said, we came up with a line, let me get this straight. And it's like, bump, bump, bump.
Right.
The next line could be, you shack up with your orthodontist, and the next thing you know, you're married to him. Hey, thanks, babe.
Yeah.
That could have been the next line. But instead, the line ended up being...
It was the football team, right?
We have a football team now because the Houston Oilers had moved to Nashville.
And they almost won the Super Bowl.
That was it. And ended up, that was just being one of those kind of like locks that got opened. On the day we came up with it.
So Chuck saved. He comes home.
Yeah.
Big hullabaloo.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure it's like cover of People magazine. He's probably Lazarus, doing the rounds.
Lazarus laughed. Whole thing. Yes.
The husband, the dentist, who stole away Helen Hunt, mm-hmm. who's grieving. Now he's home.
Yeah.
Chuck's been there 24 hours, drives to the house in the middle of the night, and the husband sleeps through all of it.
Chuck's not on the radar at all.
You think he's lying in bed going like, I hope my wife handles this moment correctly?
I believe that was by Chris Noth, and I believe he's up there in bed wondering how long it's going to be till he hears his wife come up the stairs and slide into the sheets.
She runs out in the rain at one point, screams, Chuck!
Yeah, runs out,
big makeout session in the driveway, and then Chuck sends her packing. She just goes back to bed?
Well, she goes back to bed and has a very long discussion, you know, and I think there's probably going to be a little frostiness in the house for a
that marriage the next is not couple lasted. Of days. They're getting divorced.
Oh, you're a cynic. You're a cynic. They work it out, man, because even the husband knows, I got to say, I was not expecting that guy to come back.
Yeah, so, I was honey, second choice.
Honey, you're going to have to go through something. And by the way, in 3 months, you and I will be in couples therapy. We'll be getting some counseling in order to work this out.
That's Castaway too. They're in couple therapy and Chuck is still bringing a volleyball around and people are wondering what's going on with him.
No, everybody says, where's Wilson? Where's Wilson? He floated away. Did you not see the movie? It's like, you know, that rosebud sled got burned in the bonfire at the end of Citizen Kane. He's gone, baby, gone.
I think Chuck has a lot of issues over the next couple of years, but eventually is fine. Maybe Bettina helps him. Maybe living in the ranch, maybe that helps them.
Well, you know, that started off because when we were, very early in the first years that we were working on it, Bill said, you know, look, how do you think this movie really begins? And I said, I'll tell you how it begins. It begins with me, and I'm in a tree somewhere in this beautiful farm somewhere, and I got little kids playing at my feet. I got a big glass of iced tea, and I have a beautiful wife, that it's coming out saying, it's almost time for lunch, honey. And I look around, I say, you know, the greatest thing that ever happened to me was being in a plane crash and being stuck on an island for 4 years, because otherwise I wouldn't be here. That's the theme with which we started writing on, and you just continue on. And I think there's
You kept it more of a mystery with the final product, with the packages.
Cinema, man, cinema.
Cinema, you did it. Tell me about Finch.
This came about because a while back ago, I mean, we made it in 2000, I want to say 18.
Yeah.
The fall of 18 going into 19. I'll have to check my notes. I am a competitive son of a bitch who wants to have the best role in the movie of anything that I read. And I read this thing about the last man on earth who is not just trying to survive, not just trying to eat, not just trying to escape the bad guys and take a shower. His whole reason for living is to build a companion that will take care of his dog. I told people about this. What is this movie you're doing? It's a bunch of dystopian thing. Well, yeah, it's that, you know, and there's a robot and blah, blah, blah. But it's really about a guy who wants to make sure his dog is safe and goes on beyond him. And everybody goes,
People love dogs. Yeah.
Plus, you
killed Hooch, so you had to do something to make up for dogs.
We learned that lesson. Yeah. Do not kill, even if you have a puppy later on, do not kill the hero dog.
My wife is still furious a million years later. Yeah. Just can't believe Hooch didn't make it. Maybe had a cast. No, he's dead.
I remember fighting for the fight for the death of Hooch, saying, in the grand Disney tradition of Old Yeller, Hooch must die. not the smartest words. Miguel Sapochnik directed Finch, and Miguel is the granddaddy of Game of Thrones. He directed the meat and potatoes of Game of Thrones, which actually, when I saw some of them, the last three were airing at the time we were working. We had all gathered at Miguel's house in Albuquerque, watched them. And then as soon as they were done, I'd find him and say, Miguel, how did you make these things? These are the most complex, multi-layered, and he would describe a brutal shooting schedule and all this other stuff that goes on. So in the relative scheme of things, me, Caleb Landry Jones as the Jeff the robot, and the dog, whose name I'll scream out here in a second. I'm having a cranial plate shift. I'm remembering Hooch, not the.
I screwed you up. I kept bringing up Hooch.
That's all right. The three of us were relative stroll in the park. But there, it's one of those movies that for me is like, this is all about procedure and behavior, man. Yeah. There are things that have to be, and we cannot shortchange them. And it was also co-written by one of the former art directors who worked on 2001: A Space Odyssey with Stanley Kubrick. So I was all over. I was all over him about all of that. And it was a movie that beat the living daylights out of us all.
Well, it comes out.
It was a hard movie to make.
Comes out this weekend on Apple.
On streaming only on Apple. Yeah. And we'll see what that means to the zeitgeist.
Well, I intentionally left a lot of Tom Hanks movies left for that we didn't discuss for whenever you come back. Because you're always invited back whenever you want.
Oh,
we
still have
to go through.
Great.
We have to go through the 90s.
Well, you know, the 2000s doesn't have to always be. This is your life, man. You know.
No, it's but like I had a lot of movie questions. So you've been in my life for 40 plus years. I had to get some questions answered.
You know, I have to admit, I kind of get that. I really like that. There's people like, you know, like Paul McCartney and Ringo and these guys that have been around for an awfully long time. It's like, I love it when they go back and just say, oh, you know, I read this thing that Paul McCartney said, he was asked, did you guys know you were getting better when you were in Hamburg, you know, playing on the Reeperbahn?
Right.
Did you know? And it's like, but that's actually a pretty interesting question. Did they know they were getting better? They said, well, we were always trying, you know, we never played the same songs. You know, there were other bands who would come in and just bang out the set. And that was it. We were always throwing new stuff in, never doing it in the same order. And there was a club down the Reeperbahn that had a jukebox. And when we would close up, we'd run down, you know, to the jukebox and hear what was the latest. And, you know, we'd hear Elvis singing, it's now or never, come hold me tight. And we'd play it four times and write down the lyrics and figure out the chords. And then we'd play that the next night, you know, at the club. And it's you hear that, it's like, wow, that kind of like tells the story of everything they've done since, you know. I love hearing that stuff. So it's good in order to go back and ponder it. Although sometimes it's like, I might remember a little too much of that stuff and still have problems remembering where my kids are now.
I'm like that with sports. I can remember everything that's happened to any Boston team, and yet I'll get my kids' birthdays. I'm originally from Boston. Yeah.
All right. So, okay. Let me tell you my one. This is the baseball story that I
tell. Let's hear it.
All right. I'm doing Nothing in Common in Chicago with Jackie Gleason, Eva Marie Saint, Bess Armstrong, Celia Ward. I've never been to Chicago before. So this is kind of a great thing. I get tickets to Wrigley Field, still no lights, day games only at Wrigley Field. They had the campaign, no lights. You know, everybody had signs, no lights, don't destroy Wrigley Field, no lights. Sunday game against the Cincinnati Reds. As Pete Rose is coming closer and closer and closer to Ty Cobb's record.
Right.
Right? All right. Long game. Guess what? With another hit, he will tie Ty Cobb's record. With just one more hit, we will be there for the historical moment when Pete Rose and Ty Cobb are at the same place on the all-time hit list. A rainstorm comes up, as it only can in Chicago, and it is as though the ghost of Ty Cobb is saying, no, not today, pal. Not today. It rained, Bill, it rained for close to 2 hours. The tarp was out. Most of the people left, but those that didn't, I had nothing to do on a Sunday, so I wasn't about to go back to the hotel. And I was with a buddy of mine. So we stayed and drank beer and talked to people and blah, blah, blah. All right, 2 hours go by. Looks like the rain has stopped. Lo and behold, it has. Oh, it looks like they're coming out to take the tarp off the infield. Holy cow, they are. They're going to keep playing. Roll it up, roll it up, roll it up. Da, 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 da. It's getting dark. There are no lights. Oh, holy cow. Who is on deck?
Pete Rose.
Pete Rose is on deck and in the top of whatever inning it was. Cubs play out their bottom, and here it comes. First batter goes up. And as he's taking swings, the umpire calls the game on account of darkness. And Pete Rose is there with the donut, you know, the weighted donut on his back. And I could read his lips. And he was saying, I can see. I can see.
Wow.
It's not that dark. And then whenever the next game was back in Cincinnati is when he tied the record and broke the record.
Jesus.
How about that? That's baseball, man. That's a good baseball
sport. And you had to sit through the whole rain delay, man.
Oh, what better thing to do?
Nothing I guess at Wrigley. That. Perfect. Yeah. All right. Tom Hanks, good luck with the movie. Thanks for coming on. It was great.
Thanks very much.
Great to meet you and do this. Hope to do it again at some point.
Good to talk to you. Let's do it again.
All right. Thanks.
Peace and love.
All right. Thanks to Tom Hanks. This podcast was produced by Kyle Creighton. Good luck to Willow's football 8th grade tomorrow. And I will see you on Sunday night.